Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is Sod 2 of For the Record program number 500, Conversation with Sander Hicks and Alan Duncan. This is being recorded on February 27th of the year 2005. Sander Hicks, Alan Duncan, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Thanks, David.
In side one, we were talking about Operation Diamondback. Randy Glass was the sting man, so to speak. He was sort of directing the players in this. And he had information that was communicated when he was wired for sound, by the way, by R.G. Abbas, a Pakistani intelligence agent, who in June of 1999 at the Tribeca Grill in New York City pointed to the World Trade Center towers and said, "They're coming down." In side one, we explored the links between Operation Diamondback and Dr. Magdi El Amir, an apparent financier, an alleged financier of Osama bin Laden, and a client of Michael Chertoff, now the head of Department of Homeland Security, and an individual blamed by other DHS agents with having helped to subdue Operation Green Quest, the pursuit of terrorist financing, the investigation that he was in charge of. Now, Randy Glass, when we were concluding the conversation on side one, Randy Glass had gone to Senator Robert Graham of Florida and basically was blowing the whistle. Let's resume the narrative at that point. Again, fill us in on what Randy Glass and Robert Graham spoke about and what sort of a response there was on a part of officialdom.
Sure. So in the summer of 2001, Randy Glass was frantically faxing a handwritten fax that I will reproduce in our book, The Big Wedding. And this fax talked about his frustration and his confusion because he said, "I know about the attacks." At one point, he called somebody up in the State Department. He said he had to call 50 different people until he called one of the higher-ups who happened to know that he was an informant and knew they knew who he was. And this higher-up at the State Department said, "Randy, stop talking about an attack on the World Trade Center. We know all about planes being flown into the World Trade Center." And that's a direct quote. Randy's got it on tape. And
that quote is from Senator Robert Graham.
No, that's not from Senator Robert Graham. That's from a higher up at the State Department.
Oh, okay.
That I'm not free to name right now, and but I'll be probably naming it for certain in the book, or naming that gentleman for certain in the book.
And your forthcoming book, by the way, is called The Big Wedding.
Right, right. This is sort of one of the big smoking guns, and it's really creepy. I think the State Department and the FBI and the CIA and all the rest of them are in some big trouble here, because Randy Glass, who they took from being a jewelry con man and they turned him into a spy, Randy Glass is in the habit of taping everything. And so I'm going to be journeying down to Florida pretty soon and actually trying to get a copy of those tapes, because he was taping a lot of his phone conversations, and that was true in the summer of 2001 when he was told to definitely not go to the media and definitely shut up and stop worrying about it. But you see, the thing is, they sort of showed their hand a little bit, because all Randy knew was that R.G. Abbas had told him that those towers are coming down, that the World Trade Center was going to be attacked. The State Department said to him, "Shut up about it. We know all about planes being flown into the World Trade Center." He never told them he knew about planes being flown into the World Trade Center. He didn't. He only knew about an attack, see? So it's really creepy. If this story is true, that means that we have a State Department who knows, in July and August of 2001, who knows all about planes being flown into the World Trade Center.
It's also very interesting, too. Now, Alan, you're a former policeman. I'm not sure what the technical legal definition of foreknowledge is, but that sounds awfully damn close if it isn't on the head.
Yeah, definitely. You know, a lot of the information that Sybil Edmonds came up with, too. I mean, she claims to have translated from a source in Afghanistan that talked all about the details of 9/11. And that's probably one of the reasons she's being gagged.
Mm-hmm. And just this past week, by the way, Sybil Edmonds was the Justice Department said that her investigation should not be pursued because it could damage national security. So the That happened. Now, again, recapitulating and correcting my own mnemonic error here, when Randy Glass was talking to State Department people trying to warn them about what R.G. Abbas had discussed at the Tribeca Grill, they said, we know all about the planes and so forth. An as-yet-unnamed publicly official at State said, we know all about the planes. What happened after that? Where did that go from there?
Well, Randy Glass went to jail because his work for FBI and ATF was over. He got a reduced sentence, and he had to do 7 months. So it's going to be really hard to convince some of these paranoid establishment media figures that he's a credible source, because a lot of people have an automatic dismissal when you say, oh, well, this guy's done some time. It's a situation, unfortunately, all too similar to situations I've been in the past with my old friend Jim Hatfield, who wrote a book on Bush called Fortunate Son. Having skeletons in your closet, or in Randy Glass's case, being a convicted criminal is going to severely damage a kind of a bourgeois notion of credibility. That said, Randy Glass has got a lot of inertia and reputation behind him because he's been such a great source for Dateline NBC. So it remains to be seen how a book that has a fully fleshed out explanation of Randy Glass's information and why it's important to understanding 9/11, it remains to be seen what the effect will eventually be. But the story sort of ends because Randy Glass, when 9/11 happened, he was in jail. He got on the phone, he talked to his former handlers at FBI, some of whom were hostile to him, but some of whom were friendly. Those handlers I've also personally contacted and talked to and have determined that, you know, that what Randy Glass says is true. And, he wanted to get out of where he was, and he wanted to help react. He wanted to help fight this. You know, his political consciousness is not such that he really can, I think, fully understand how Al-Qaeda could be a tool of CIA rather than an enemy of CIA. So he was more on the patriotic kick at that moment.
Mm-hmm. My own take, by the way, on a lot of this, the relationship between the Muslim Brotherhood initially, then its offshoot, the MAK in Afghanistan,
yeah,
and then finally the derivative, Al-Qaeda, their long-standing relationship with CIA, but I suspect that the relationship is not as simple as a simple tool. In fact, I think that to a certain extent, somebody done hoodooed the hoodoo man in this context. But it's complex. In other words, the Hitler-Stalin pact took place, but ultimately wound up in a disaster. And it's I think when CIA made a deal with this particular devil, they didn't realize quite with whom they were dealing. But it's a very complex state of affairs. I think there are elements of the CIA that don't really work for America at all. I mean, it would take some discussion of deep politics, but
I
think
I agree with you, David. And in fact, that's one of the paradigms paradigm shift I'm going to try to advance in the book, is to not try to understand the nation state as being a discrete entity, but nation states are permeable, and intelligence services are constantly infiltrated by each other. So we had moles inside of Al-Qaeda, and Al-Qaeda had moles inside of CIA and FBI.
Mm. Which
is what Sibel Edmonds said, right, Alan?
Mm. Yeah. And the comparison that I've used, and I don't want to take a significant amount of time, but the long, long discussions that I have in print and on audio file about September 11th, I compare September 11th with the subversion of France running up to and during World War II. The French power elite, to make a long story short, had strong business and ideological affiliations with their German counterparts. They were more afraid of the Democrats with a small d in their own country than they were of foreign fascists. And so the French power elite, their industrialists, their financiers, their aristocrats, church leaders, and many military and police officials actively subverted the French military resistance in World War II because they needed a defeat in World War II to eliminate democracy. And they were already part of international cartels, though it's redundant, but with their German compatriots. And it's one of the reasons why France capitulated so quickly. They were done in from within. It is an imprecise analogy. But I think that in terms of analyzing what actually took place, I think one of the things that said that September 11th looms against is globalization and the actual subjugation of the nation state to a multinational, globalized corporate state. But anyway, that's my take. Let's focus back, you know, in terms of setting the context here. Ultimately, again, Randy Glass began blowing the whistle. And he was blowing the whistle to people at State who then revealed to him that they knew about planes being flown in, and he didn't know about that. And we'll leave that State Department official unnamed, and I'll leave it to your discretion, gentlemen, as to how, to what extent we want to name some of these other names at this point. There's an individual named Dave. Last name begins with the letter F. What would you like to tell us about him?
Yeah, I think it's okay to name him. Michael Rupert is the guy that first tipped me off to this gentleman's name. His name is David Frasca. He was the head of the Radical Fundamentalist Unit at FBI before 9/11, and was instead of being chastised or castigated or punished for what some people call gross incompetence, he was promoted. And I think that is one of the biggest ways to defeat, logically, the mainstream opinion that 9/11 happened because of U.S. intelligence incompetence. If that's the case, then why have people like Dave Frasca not been punished? In fact, they've been promoted across the board. The same goes for Robert Mueller. George Tenet, until recently, had his job. Richard Myers, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, was confirmed 2 days after 9/11. It doesn't make any sense. So it seems that, multiple fingers are being pointed at David Frasca. I interviewed Colleen Rowley, the Time Magazine Woman of the Year, for being a whistleblower in Minneapolis at the Minneapolis FBI. She also was agreed with me about David Frasca. In fact, David Frasca, his name comes up in the Randy Glass investigation because there is a low-level, virtuous, kind of a grunt, the grunt level of the ATF, a guy by the name of Steve Barberini. Who Randy Glass worked with, and Barberini and he are still pretty friendly. And I actually said to Barberini, I was like, can you believe it that, I said something like, what do you think about David Frasca? And he said something like, oh, I'm sure at this point that Frasca has been demoted, or that Frasca is no longer, you know, working in headquarters. And I was like, are you kidding me? I mean, are you not reading the papers? Frasca is now number three in charge of domestic terrorism. And Barberini was very surprised, let's put it that way. And he said to me, that's why I fight to stay at the bottom. I thought that was really kind of endearing in a way, that like this guy, he's just trying to do his job. He's a blue-collar crime fighter at the ATF. He's not trying to be a careerist. And I said something like, how do you explain this guy getting promoted? And he said something like, well, you know, you've been in organizations before, obviously. You know, you've probably had experiences where the people that can't do the job get promoted. In this case, though, I don't think we're talking about somebody who couldn't do the job. I think we're talking about somebody who's making a career out of pleasing some very rich and powerful people in this country. And these people don't have democracy or the will of the people or as part of their set of interests. Their interests include global domination, the accumulation of extreme amounts of wealth, and the protection of a power elite.
I could add something real quick, too. You know, Dave Frasca was also involved in blocking the Ken Williams memo from Phoenix.
There you go.
And in Randy Glass's case, you're talking briefly about the passport that Theo Moishan claimed he could get.
One second, Alan.
Got a passport from Theo Moishan, and when they tried to get the money to buy it, I forget it was $17,000 or something. Apparently, Dave Frasca blocked giving government money to get this passport, and Randy and the agents had to come up with their own money to buy the passport. So he claims that Frasca constantly interfered and sabotaged their case.
Now, which passport was this?
This was the special passport that Dia Moishan said that he had that allowed him to pass unmolested into any country he wanted to go into, despite being an international arms dealer.
All righty. And now, the Ken Williams memo, real briefly, if you would fill us in, Alan, on that one. I'm familiar with it. Many of the listeners may be, but review for those who aren't, please.
Yeah, Ken Williams is an FBI agent in the Phoenix, Arizona area, and he came across with information that there were, you know, quite a few Middle Eastern people taking flight lessons out there. And red flag went up to him, and he tried to alert the FBI in Washington, and apparently the memo was never passed on, and from what I heard, Dave Frask had something to do with blocking that, too. So now we have him blocking the Ken Williams case, the Colleen Raleigh case, where he, you know, blocked her getting a warrant and then interfering with the Operation Diamondback. So it's interesting how this guy who nobody ever heard of before, his name keeps popping up in these really critical cases prior to 9/11.
There was a name that you mentioned earlier, Alan, that we have not really kicked around very much. This is doubling back to a certain extent. Mike Malik, who was he and what is his significance?
Mike Malik was a businessman in Jersey City. Apparently, he owned a number of businesses, a liquor store, a little deli. He owned a phone card business. By the way, R.G. Abbas was actually employed. They actually worked together, and at that meeting at the Tribeca Grill, R.G. Abbas actually gave a business card to Randy, claiming that he worked for Malik. Interestingly enough, the government claims they could never track down R.G. Abbas, and yet Dateline just called him. He fled to Pakistan, but he was living there for a while. Mike Malik comes into the picture later in the story. He came up with a whole list. He came up with a whole menu of items he wanted to build a nuclear dirty bomb, including dirty water, and which is interesting because this guy got away with no jail time at all. All references to Pakistan were cleansed from his record. And I just think it's kind of interesting. And his lawyers say he has no connections with people overseas, and yet the government claimed that all these people had legitimate contacts with people in Pakistan. And, excuse me, and, you know, I just wonder how somebody who runs a deli in Jersey City can come up with a detailed list of components for a nuclear dirty bomb without having some kind of information about that beforehand or somebody coaching them on, you know?
Yeah. You know, there's and again, I'm critical of Dateline NBC, and yet there's some really great stuff that they did, too. They also staked out Mike Malik and or Mike Malik, if you like that pronunciation. And they showed up at his convenience store, and they put a camera in his face, and they asked him about all this stuff. And, you know, he was, like, denying everything. But he's not that hard to find, you know. He walked. You know, when Dia Moishin got 30 months slap on the wrist, Mike Malik didn't just completely walked with, I think, just a fine or something, or got probation or something.
I also wanted to mention, too, Dateline just did another story in January where they revisited Operation Diamondback. And the agents at the time didn't realize that some of the people that came over from Pakistan were actually part of the AQ-Con nuclear network.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And talking to Randy Glass, he claims that AQ-Con actually sent his top assistant to the United States to inspect weapons-grade plutonium, which our government actually provided for inspection. So that's something interesting that has just come about. But the agents working it weren't even aware who AQ-Con was or the network or anything until, you know, recent news came out about it.
Yeah, and one of the things that looms throughout the investigation of the various parts of September 11th, again, an extremely complex event, and that is often legal investigative procedures cut across profound economic and diplomatic relationships, and very often the right thing to do, the thing that would have saved lives and upheld law, is completely subjugated to the perceived integrity of the economic relationship, and that's one of the things that looms large, and it's one of the reasons why the Bush endowed oil family has done so little about some of the connections that run in the direction of Saudi Arabia, which is, you know, it's much, much larger than just Saudi Arabia. But then the Bushes are deeply involved with that milieu. And the AQ-Con thing is a fascinating state of affairs. What is your take? Now, in the chapter that you emailed to me, Sander, you note that the person who was nominally in charge of the BCCI investigation and who, according to many people, including John Kerry and Mr. Morgenthau in New York, actually attenuated the BCCI investigation, leaving out the many, many intelligence connections, was none other than Robert Mueller, now head of the FBI. The BCCI is one of the foundational elements that underlies the milieu of September 11th. I'd like to get both of your takes, both you, Sandra, and you, Alan. What do you think of Mueller? What do you think of BCCI? What's your view on how this factors into the quote investigation unquote of September 11th?
Yeah, well, geez, it's starting with Colleen Rowley, the heroic Minneapolis FBI lawyer who was became well known as the whistleblower. I mean, she herself is not going as far as she could in her analysis of things, but and she's something of a political moderate. Although I admire the hell out of her, but starting with her statement, even as a moderate, is just vitriolic, and she accuses Robert Mueller of, she uses very polite language in her official complaint, but she effectively says that you are guilty of some sort of really strange cover-up here. So using that as a starting point, I think you've got to go back in the big picture and look at the fact that, Senator Kerry's Foreign Relations Committee report on their BCCI investigation. In the very first couple of paragraphs, he says, I want the American public to know that we were stymied every step of the way by the criminal division of the Department of Justice. And the person who headed up the criminal division of the Department of Justice at the time was Robert Mueller, and then was, appointed director of FBI later. So, and I think BCCI is really important. The author of Forbidden Truth, Jean-Claude Brizard, who I believe has connections to French intelligence.
No doubt about it, yeah.
He says that on behalf of French intelligence, I believe that the results of their investigations were that Osama bin Laden assumed control of the exact same financial network that BCCI had. And I guess we should, in all fairness, review what BCCI was.
Mm-hmm.
In The Outlaw Bank by Jonathan Beatty and S.C. Gwynne, these award-winning reporters, they keep on coming up and talking to sources who say, first of all, stop thinking that it's a bank. It's not a bank. It's more like an international organization that is dealing in black market activities, narcotics, weapons dealing, financial arrangements, under the guise of being a third world empowering kind of bank. It was founded by a Pakistani named Abidi, and his idea was that this was going to be the third world's capital source. You know, kind of like it's very similar to the World Bank. I've got family that have worked all their lives at the World Bank, which, as critics know, that it's the World Bank is, under the guise of humanism, is the same old global capitalism, you know, with all the brutality and the tough stakes that capitalism dishes out to the international working class. So BCCI, when it was basically a lot like Enron, too. It could be compared to Enron as well, because it was a something of a shell game. It was something that, when it finally collapsed, it was the biggest financial scandal in history monetarily, because mm-hmm. the shareholders and the lenders got stuck with the bill, which I believe was upwards of $14 billion, something like that.
It was huge, and it's still in litigation. By the way, their warehouses, their fireproof warehouses for the BCCI records in London, experienced something like 7 different fires, and one of which killed a couple of firemen in London. But these, somebody definitely. Let's just say that the records were indeed literally and figuratively hot.
Right, right. I'm going to check my facts there. Oh, by the way, I'm Catherine Graham.
Uh-huh.
Was the aunt of Senator Bob Graham.
Okay, I thought there was a relationship. So not his mother, but his aunt.
There you go.
Okay. And BCCI, by the way, we're down to our last few minutes here. Let me just, Kelsey, BCCI not only underlies the milieu of September 11th, but indeed, as you noted, Sander, it's very much like Enron and the BCCI, Enron, and many corporations and criminal enterprises and overlapping intelligence operations of a number of countries are increasingly using what is known as offshore, not just physically offshore, but tax havens, including Liechtenstein, Panama, Luxembourg, Switzerland, the Channel Islands, the Cayman Islands, and these figure not only in BCCI, not only in Enron, but also in the financial networks underlying September 11th, in particular the Altaqua network as well. And it's one of the things that muddies these investigations, because you're dealing with the laws of different countries, international finance, and networks that are opaque to overt investigation.
It's funny also, too, to think about it this way. The BCCI had its own militia, its own intelligence wing. It's almost as if the CIA has created a precedent that the Third World and the international criminal class is sort of mimicking. You know, it's almost like the CIA, by dealing in clandestine operations, are now being mimicked by, you know, even more criminal elements out there in the world.
Well, I think if I were going to sum up September 11th, in one sense, it'd be that there was a great old blues harmonica player named Junior Wells, and he had an album, he had a song called Somebody Done Hoodoo to Hoodoo Man, and I think that's how I would sum things up. Gentlemen, we're down to the last couple of minutes here. Alan Duncan, how would you like to, some closing remarks from you, in what would you like to leave the audience with?
Well, just that we need to keep digging, keep looking into this. It's the most complicated and convoluted story I've ever come across, but, you know, I know the 9/11 families and myself and Sibel Edmonds and a lot of good people continue to fight for the truth, and we'll keep doing it until we find out some answers.
All righty. Sander, any closing remarks before we give contact information again for both of you?
Sure, sure. Well, first of all, checking my facts, I think the BBC reported that it was $1.8 billion. That's, so according to mainstream sources, I've heard it reported different ways that BCCI was resulting in $1.8 billion. But anyway, conclusive remarks. I think that this is a great opportunity for peace activists and people of all kinds of political and spiritual progressive persuasions to start a people's investigation and a people's tribunal someday. I think people that are as powerful as David Frasca and Robert Mueller and George W. Bush and Rumsfeld and Ashcroft, those people need to be tried in a kind of a populist forum that relies on truth and democracy rather than on power and money.
Okay. And contact information for both of you very quickly.
Yeah, sure. Alan and I are both available through the Drench Kiss Media Corporation website. That's Drench, DrenchKiss.com. You'll see Alan's his actor photo, because Alan also has done some acting, and he's got his police officer forearms crossed like he's not going to take it anymore. And I'm also there, as well as on SanderHicks.com. And the new Vox Pop publishing company, Coffee House Bookstore, is at voxpopnet.net.
All righty. And all of these broadcasts, all of the For the Record shows, are being archived by sister station WFMU-FM right there in Jersey City, New Jersey. More recent shows are streaming on Real Audio, and now also many of them on MP3 at www.wfmu.org/Dave Emery. Older shows available at a longer URL, linked to both that address and to the For the Record section of the Spitfire website, www.spitfirelist.com. There will be a long written annotated description for the Record 500 in the For the Record section. And for listeners who only listen to the audio files, please do not neglect the Spitfire website, because there is a wealth of information. Hundreds, perhaps at this point, thousands of pages of printed information available. Often the written descriptions have information I did not have time to fit in the original broadcast. And the contact information for both Sander and Alan will be in the description for the Record 500. This concludes Side 2 of For the Record 500, a conversation with Sander Hicks and Alan Duncan. For Sander Hicks and Alan Duncan, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.